like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guests today are Matt and Phil Letton, siblings who are also known as the Vegan Bros. The Lettons are co-authors of the new book, Vodka is Vegan, a manifesto for better living and not being an a-hole. As the title and subtitle suggest, the book is brimming with attitude, while the brothers recount their unlikely and divergent paths towards veganism, discuss some of the more significant reasons why non-vegans may want to consider joining their ranks, not only avoiding the sanctimonious, off-putting manner of preachy vegans, but openly mocking those folks. They also make an irreverent, appealing, pretty irresistible case for embracing a vegan lifestyle, and a breezy guide for doing so. This might be loosely described as a how to become vegan book, but is wildly different in approach, tone, and content from others of that ilk. We'll hear bits of the brothers' individual stories, incidents that precipitated the book and helped shape some of the sections in Vodka is Vegan, and more when I speak with Matt and Phil Letton in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later in the show, I'll speak with Marilyn Weaver, executive director of the Florida chapter of the League of Humane Voters, about the effort afoot to persuade Governor Scott to reassign the case of the Ocala teacher who drowned two raccoons and an opossum in front of a group of his students to a different state attorney, since the initial state attorney refused to file charges against the teacher. Yes, Governor Scott is the lamest of lame ducks, but we must try. Right now, though, let's get to the Vegan Brothers with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Matt and Phil Letton on Talking Animals. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Duncan. We're excited to be
Thanks
here.
Thanks so much for having us on.
I'm going to probably have to take a little time to be able to tell the voices apart, hopefully before the end of the interview, but welcome both of you guys. And Matt, I'd like to start with you if I could, chiefly, I guess, because you're the eldest, but I ask you to describe a little bit about what life was growing up like in the Letton family, maybe with a particular emphasis on things that might seem more surprising or notable relative to your current status as the Vegan Bros.
Well, you know, we grew up on the other side of the tracks. We are two of the most unlikely vegans. I mean, we grew up about an hour outside of Detroit on, you know, for me, I would say meat three times a day, but for me, it was probably more like four to five times a day. I struggled with obesity growing up. But we also grew up just eating a lot of meat. And really, we grew up with this odd upbringing where we actually had the idea that vegans were actually like weird and bad people. So we grew up a little bit different than most, and I'm straight up on the opposite side of the track. And we really wrote this book to usher in the age of the new vegan. You know, in the past, there were stereotypes associated with vegan eating, but today, people from all walks of life are exploring the lifestyle. Celebrities, professional athletes, they're going vegan in droves. And, you know, we just noticed this as we evolved. As we evolved from the most unlikely vegans, we started to realize that, like, you know, we have all these friends now that are like investment bankers, military, police officers, stay-at-home moms, pastors, people from all across the board are embracing vegan eating. And yeah, I mean, we're two of the most unlikely guys to be ushering it in, which is kind of why it's so exciting for us.
Well, I want to get into some of the specifics of the unlikeliness based on the prelude to that. For example, since we're sort of discussing your formative years and maybe the attitudes early on, maybe this is a good moment to hear a little bit about the thing with Phil and McDonald's. Phil, can you recount that period?
Yeah, I love McDonald's. That was my favorite restaurant growing up. But yeah, so I mean, I ate meat for the first 17 years of my life, and I was a big McDonald's fan. And
well, not just that, I guess, but part of what seemed interesting about that, which is why I brought it up, is that it sounds like from the accounts in the book that as a family, you guys would go out somewhere kind of cool and interesting for dinner. And then you insisted that after that, nonetheless, people would go to McDonald's, or at least you would.
I was a little bit entitled. I was a picky eater. We took a vacation. In the book, we talked specifically about we took a vacation to Puerto Rico. And, you know, we're, the rest of the family, you know, my parents and Matt, you know, we'd go out to eat, and they would all, you know, eat at, you know, whatever restaurant we would go to. And I'm just the picky eater, and I'm all about McDonald's. So after the restaurant, we'd head to McDonald's, and I would get my food. And Matt would get his second meal.
Nice. Well, there you go. And then I guess in some of what you just said there, Phil, kind of brings me in a way to, I mean, I guess there's a number of ways that the Vegan Bros story is kind of engaging, if not striking, including, again, as I mentioned in the introduction, kind of the somewhat divergent paths that you guys each took traveling towards veganism. Let's spend a moment or two talking about those paths. Matt, for reasons that may be obvious to you, I'd like to kind of start on your path, because for many, freshman year in college, challenging time, new freedoms, new experiences. And for some, that can also mean the freshman 15, which is kind of a phrase, obviously, that refers to a pretty common weight gain for people just in their initial months or year of college. But Matt, you kind of were apparently pursuing a more ambitious agenda in terms of some of the eating that often goes on in that freshman year.
I would call it, we could call it the freshman year infinity. I mean, I was definite, like, you know, when you talk about freshman year, freshman year in college, that can be hard. That was probably the hardest time in my life. I had struggled with being overweight growing up, but my first year of college, I was actually commuting. We lived in Michigan with our parents at the time, and I was commuting to college that first year. And I would eat fast food at least 3 times per day. Potentially during that day, I could be swinging through McDonald's, Taco Bell, Wendy's, and 7-Eleven for a Slurpee. Also, potentially making some of my own frozen pizzas and rich chocolate shakes at home. So I really struggled. I really struggled with emotional eating. I remember being called Fasto the first time in third grade, and I really withdrew into myself and coped with food. And freshman year of college was a very difficult experience because, you know, a lot of my friends had gone away to college, but I was commuting, and really just, I felt like if I think back on it, I really felt like a zombie. Like I felt like I just had no purpose or direction in my life. I felt like I was just going through the motions, going from fast food drive-through to fast food drive-through, and was really lost. And also at that time, I was a very kind of negative and antagonistic person. So, you know, my brother Phil was actually the first one on board the vegan train. And, you know, when he went vegan, he actually, you know, one of the things we get into the book is, you know, for a period of time, he was kind of the vegan stereotype of the past, where he was a little bit militant and abrasive with me. And for us, what that meant is I already had a negative perception of vegans. So it was Clash of the Titans. If he was talking about veganism, I was talking about bacon and eating it in front of him. If our mom would make a vegan meal, this is no joke. If our mom would make a vegan meal, bring it to the table and say, you know, if she brought it to the table and said, "Hey guys, here's spaghetti," I'm like, "Oh, give it to me, let's eat." But if she brought it to the table and she identified it and said, "Hey guys, this is a vegan meal for Phil," I would, no joke, I would flip out, yell at everyone, leave the house, and go to Taco Bell.
Well, no, it does sound like it was there were some contentious times there early on. And so just a little bit more on the college thing. So, you touch on this in the book, but looking back, what was really, do you think, behind that kind of eating? I mean, you were commuting from the family home, but was it sort of like the loneliness and isolation that often accompanies the beginning of college? Or was there something else more profound going on, just because in some ways it makes a more significant difference to see how you kind of reversed course?
Well, I think it's just a culmination of life. I mean, you know, we grew up, I mean, we had a very interesting, extremely strict like very religiously overbearing upbringing. And I think that definitely comes into play. And just the fact, I think we, you know, we moved around a decent bit when I was a kid. And I think one of our moves really impacted me significantly and kind of like felt like I left my friends, had no friends. And I ended up as the way I coped with things is I was kind of the funny fat kid. You know, I would sort of try, if I was getting into a social group, I would sort of try to make jokes just so people would laugh with me, so I wasn't concerned about them as much laughing at me.
Yeah.
But things really came to a head. I remember in college, I got to this point, and I think that a lot of people that are able to achieve transformations that don't necessarily make like linear logical sense. Like, you know, like I lost a significant amount of weight in a short amount of time. And what happened is I came to this moment. I can picture it in my dorm room in college. I'm sitting on the couch that I got at the thrift store and I pulled out a journal. And that's when you know things are getting bad, when you pull out a journal. And I remember in that moment, I felt all the feeling. I wrote down all the terrible ways I felt about myself, all the terrible, you know, I felt like I was unattractive to girls. Like I felt like, you know, everyone was making fun of me. I thought I was ugly and just didn't want to be seen. I even kind of stopped taking care of myself. So, you know, I wasn't like doing my hair when I'm going to class. Like I'm just kind of letting myself go. And I wrote down, I allowed myself to feel these feelings. And then for some reason I got this, like I caught the wind of a dream and I wrote down a goal. And at that time I was 265 pounds and things had gotten really out of hand. And I wanted to get back down to around 200. I thought, hey, would it be cool if I could get under that 200 mark? So I set a goal to lose 65 pounds. The rest is history. Everything spiraled upward from there. I worked up the nerve to talk to a good friend in college who was super into like weightlifting. He was a college football player. And I mean, that took a lot of nerve. That took everything I had to ask someone for help because I felt so lost. I used doctor's notes to get out of gym class the entire time growing up. So I had never even set foot into a gym. But that began to change me. Over the course of the next 9 months, I basically lost 100 pounds. What this did is this put me on a path of, you know, fitness and nutrition empowering me and making me feel confident about wanting to accomplish more in life. And really what happened is that's how I came to you know, vegetarian and then veganism is through that time I began to open up and blossom as a person. And Phil had begun to completely change. He had gotten into animal advocacy, so he's working with nonprofit groups. He grew up shy and socially awkward, so he couldn't even hold a conversation until he was out of college. But at this time he had blossomed as a person. And so he was no longer, you know, batting me over the head with this vegan stuff. He was actually like this cool guy just doing good work and kind of just a really good communicator. And basically, you know, the long story short is eventually he got me.
Yeah. Well, say what you will about journaling, but it sounds like in some ways that kind of made a key difference, or at least launched you on the path.
There's no question about it.
Yeah. Let me let folks know, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guests are Matt and Phil Letton, a.k.a. the Vegan Bros. They've published a new book, Vodka is Vegan, a Manifesto for Better Living and Not Being an A-Hole. If you'd like to ask either of them or both a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So, Phil, let's get you back involved in the conversation. By the way, just so you know, there's some careful listeners out there to the show, because one of the emails that came in a few minutes ago said, how does one vacay in Puerto Rico whilst growing up on the wrong side of the track? So there's some very discerning listeners out there. So anyways, but let's carry on. Phil, like I say, we've kind of missed you as we heard a little bit of Matt's story. So why don't you step forward and pick up the narrative a little bit? So Matt's kind of referred to what you were doing at the time, but maybe you could describe what you were doing and kind of your own, you know, maybe not as radical, at least by comparison, transformation, but just sort of the life that you were leading at this point.
Yeah, so I mean, like Matt was saying, you know, I grew up extremely shy, extremely socially awkward. Like when I think back on when I was extremely little, like, you know, like 3-5 years old, I can remember when I would be around other adults with my mom or whatever, and the other adults try to talk to me, I'm like running behind my mom trying to hide. So I'm like afraid, like I don't want them to see me. I'm like afraid they're talking to me. And you know, my mom would just kind of like let me do that. And before you know it, I'm, you know, 22 years old, graduated from college, and I'm still the shy, socially awkward, you know, person that I've always been. And it was when I graduated, and it was just like, you know, I've been vegan now for a couple of years, and I wanted to do more, but I didn't know what to do. I ended up meeting up with a group that was coming through Michigan on the Warped Tour, which is a traveling like concert festival that tours around the country every summer.
Yeah.
And it was with Vegan Outreach, and they were handing out leaflets about factory farming, just to educate everyone leaving the festival every day. So I met up with them in Michigan, and I met one of my, who ended up being like probably one of the biggest mentors in my life, Vic Shadeen, who he still works for Vegan Outreach, and he really took me under his wing. I had just graduated from college. I wasn't really doing anything. I was trying to figure out what I'm doing with my life, and he's touring around the country. So I just jumped on board, and I went with him. And in doing that, you know, I went from this extremely shy, socially awkward, abrasive, militant vegan. But how those fit together is kind of weird. But that's who I was. And in hanging out with him every day, doing this advocacy work, you know, I learned effective communication. I learned how to not just, like, to me, just learning how to talk to people at that point was a thing.
Yeah.
But on top of that, I'm learning, like, high-level effective communication skills. Because, you know, generally, when you're handing out leaflets on college campuses and whatever, you know, most people are just taking them, and they're walking by, and they're thanking you. And, you know, it does have was having an impact. But every now and then, you are interacting with people who they're asking you more questions, and every now and then you're getting someone who, you know, they're not receptive, and you're having to learn how to deal with it. And over time, I'm learning how to deal with it. I'm like, in really, really just a few months, I'm learning how to not only, you know, just talk to people and answer their questions, but like, if someone is combative against me, I'm learning how to bring their energy down within a matter of like 5-10 seconds to having just a standard conversation and really becoming friends. So it's like, I got to this point where I'm extremely shy, socially awkward, abrasive, militant vegan. And in a matter of just a few months, I went from that person to now, when I'm dealing with someone who is militant against me, I'm becoming their friends, and also, you know, able to, you know, influence them and impact them to sort of, you know, to my side.
And do you think, before you turn that corner, do you think part of your sort of militant stance was the fact that you were super shy and you were just sort of overcompensating and saying, hey, let me just come out of the gate strong, even though I'm sort of not that comfortable to begin with socially?
Oh, for sure. I think that's definitely part of it. And I think another part of it is, you know, for most of my life, I didn't, you know, I'm eating meat, and I don't know how the animals are treated. And then when I turned 17, and eventually I became vegan when I was 20. And yeah, so like learning about how the animals are treated on factory farms and slaughterhouses, I mean, it's horrible.
Yeah.
And when I learned about it, it kind of, you know, messed with my head and horrified me. And it, you know, I'm sort of just like, I'm not thinking about what I'm doing and how I'm impacting people. I'm just lashing out. But then, yeah, I do think what you said about, because I'm shy and socially awkward, I don't know how to communicate. I don't know how to, you know, I don't know how to do things properly. So I'm just, it is, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I was overcompensated with that. For sure.
So again, coming from slightly different paths, you guys, one of you had further embraced veganism but dialed back the stridency, and one sort of went from some serious fast food and other kind of eating to working out and embracing veganism that way. So maybe I'd like to ask each of you to address kind of what the Vegan Bros ethos is. I mean, what are the guiding principles? People who've read the book would know this, but some people, of course, listening probably haven't had a chance yet to read the book. So if you had to express kind of the ethos or guiding principles of Vegan Bros in like, say, 2 or 3 sentences, what would those be?
Yeah, two or three sentences?
Yeah, just if you had to boil it down to kind of like, what are the key elements, key concepts for you guys?
I mean, we try to make this like a big, we want this to be a big tent. So the way we view things is, if you're opposed to animal cruelty, you're already 90% vegan. Your diet is just the last 10%. And also, we really push that we don't want people to view eating vegan as this all or nothing proposition. We want to give people permission to explore this lifestyle as little or as much as they want. And the reason we do that is because we found when we make the like, you know, I stopped eating meat 14 years ago. I've been vegan 11 years. So to me, eating this way, it's just second nature. I don't even need to think about it. But when people are just coming into this, it is a change. It is a change. over time, it becomes second nature. But in the beginning, it's a change. And so we want to make the barrier to entry as low as possible so people don't feel like they're just overwhelmed and this is something that they, it just seems impossible. It's like, maybe you're eating meat right now. Maybe you're eating a lot of meat. But there's a lot of middle ground between the way a person's eating right now and 100% vegan. Like, maybe you could cut your meat consumption in half. Meatless Mondays is a really big thing. And one of the things we like to just encourage people to do is, next time you go to the grocery store, buy whatever you normally buy, but maybe throw in some vegan products in your cart. There's a brand we really like is Beyond Meat. They have a product called Beyond Burger, and they have a brand new product called Beyond Sausage. You can maybe throw a couple of those product carts, and, it's really just about exploring.
Yeah. I was going to say that, in the past, I think some of the mistakes, and we all make mistakes along the way, I think some of the vegan movement of the past accidentally, like unintentionally, sort of gave people the idea that, that eating vegan is this, like, first of all, it's this very difficult thing, and it's this thing that you have to decide right now. You're either all in or all out. Our goal is basically to really, really obliterate that line and that feeling of this all or nothing proposition, and also just really give people permission to explore it on their own terms. I mean, we've gone, like, part of the whole point of our book is really telling people our interesting journey through life. And we recognize, we spent a lot of time judging people, being judged by people, feeling guilted and shamed and all that stuff. We know that that doesn't work for anyone. And we know that we're all on a journey of life just trying to figure stuff out. We just invite people in because we know the facts. We know the facts. Americans and people around the world, everyone's opposed to animal cruelty. Just look at your dog. Just look at your cat. We already have that going on inside of us. And the amazing thing is we live in a world now where we're just able to expand and extend our circle of compassion. We give people permission to start wherever they want.
Well, one thing I would say, just if I were going to reduce a few things from knowing about you guys and reading the book, is huge thing in multiple ways is just be kind to others. I mean, not just animals, and of course, don't be an a-hole, but also be kind to yourself, right? A big part of what you've said here and certainly say throughout the book is incremental changes is fine. It doesn't have to be all in overnight. Another point or two you make is don't wig out if you're over at somebody's house and eat something non-vegan. That's not cause for trauma or alarm, or if you accidentally even eat something at your own house. I think there was a reference to a spring roll or something in there that later was determined not to be vegan. It sounds like it's really about not having absolutes and not being judgmental any which way, and just encouraging people to move at their own pace and having it be strictly a kind of a positive, encouraging thing.
Oh, totally. It's like, we're all on a journey. We're all on a journey in life. And I think one of the things, just specifically speaking to vegans, is like, we need to be understanding of other people and other people's journey. Like, and I think it comes down to like not when you remember your own journey, when you don't judge yourself for your own journey, you can be more understanding of others. So, for me, at least, it's like, just speaking about myself, the first 17 years of my life, I was eating meat, and I was, it's not like I was like eating meat and I'm like, oh, I don't care about animals. And I think that, it doesn't matter. It's like, no, I cared about animals and I ate meat at the same time. And it wasn't until I learned, and it didn't happen overnight. I learned about how animals were treated, and I didn't go vegan overnight. It took, and I didn't even stop eating meat right then and there. It was like a year after I learned that I really actually gave up meat. So I think when we remember our own journey, it helps us be more understanding of others.
Yeah.
And I think that's important throughout, all aspects of life.
For sure. Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guests are Phil and Matt Letton, the vegan bros. They're co-authors of the book Vodka is Vegan, A Manifesto for Better Living and Not Being an A-Hole. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So you cite a number of vegan folks in the book who could serve as role models or convincing exhibit A's. And because we're into the second week of Wimbledon right now, I think it's incumbent on us almost to talk about the marvel that is Serena Williams. Talk a little bit about her and why she struck you guys so prominently in terms of citing some folks like this, and maybe trace the arc of her journey to veganism and relative to sort of other tennis champions who've retired from the game long before she's still plugging away now.
Yeah, she's one of the reasons we really liked her is she's just, I mean, we're at the point straight up where the tides have shifted in such a massive way where when people think about vegan in their mind, their first thought are some of the most elite professional athletes in the world. And I think that's the reason we picked her. That's why we included her. I mean, she is outperforming. She has outperformed her entire life, but she's now outperforming based on age. I mean, she is just completely, you know, she's still at the top of her game, finding a way to stay, not just stay relevant, but keep winning. And that's the cool thing. That's where we feel vegan eating is. I mean, now we have half of the Tennessee Titans NFL team basically is eating vegan. And we know from some of our friends like Griff Whalen in the NFL on the Oakland Raiders that over the past really 2 years, the ideas of vegan eating have really started to infiltrate like the NFL and NBA. And now, you know, general managers and owners are now dealing with the players' requests and demands, you know, to have more vegan food.
Yeah.
And so there's been those stereotypes of the past where people are like, well, how do you get your protein on a vegan diet? I mean, really, those questions are completely laid to rest because all you have to do is look at Kyrie Irving, Serena Williams, Arnold Schwarzenegger's doing it now. Like, it's just complete, like, you know, the world's Germany's strongest man. I mean, it's just the list can go on and on and on and on where, you know, basically, it's here. You know,
yeah.
You can just look.
For sure. Well, and again, Serena, 36, I think, and obviously had a baby and currently, I believe, in the semis of Wimbledon. So bringing it back to her, I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. But like you say, I mean, it's widening out to all kinds of athletes and all kinds of sports. And like you say, it's really answering the where do you get your protein question from or dismissing it before it even gets raised at this point. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, I saw Serena. I saw the highlights. I saw her finish yesterday. And I mean, she came back hard.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good point where you said you brought up dismissing it before it even gets raised. And I think, yeah, that's you hit the nail right on the head. Because in the past, it was, you know, when people would say, you know, back, you know, when I first gave up meat 14 years ago, went vegan 11 years ago, people would ask, where do you get your protein? And you would have to answer. You'd have to, like, come up with all the different sources you get your protein from. Nowadays, yeah, you can throw that stuff in there. But it's like there's so many elite professional athletes that are doing it. That really, it's like it doesn't get asked as much. And when it does, people don't push because they know it's like, wow. So if the elite professional athletes are doing it, you know, that says a lot.
For sure.
Most of us aren't elite professional athletes.
right. But everybody's doing fine on the protein front, which was kind of always the case. But yeah, those questions certainly tended to surface right off the bat. But
we think that those types of questions, honestly, are as a result of successful marketing and propaganda campaigns by what we call the meat and dairy industrial complex. You know, for a couple decades, they did a really good job of kind of pulling the wool over Americans' eyes and kind of, you know, putting these false truths in there about, like, you know, you need meat for protein, you get calcium from milk. Like, everyone now, because of the internet and the freedom of information, everyone knows that that's, you know, not true.
Well, and also, let's talk a little bit more about the book, just because I've sort of alluded to the title and that it's full of attitude and all kinds of cool, irreverent stuff, and also laced with profanity. I appreciate you guys have kept the profanity off the air today. But again, it's fun to read, and it deals with a lot of information that people who've read any kind of how to become vegan or why I became vegan kind of books. There's some overlapping information, obviously, in terms of factory farming and some other stuff that we may get into in a moment. But it's huge, I think, running theme is, like, really, as the subtitle suggests, I mean, just don't be an a-hole. Whatever it is that you're doing, whatever, and including don't be an a-hole to yourself. So again, if you're thinking about trying something, whether it's Meatless Monday or adding something to your, like you guys said, to your shopping cart that might just be trying something. I mean, there's so many incremental, easy ways to sort of just try it without feeling like you have to jump off the cliff and go all in. And I just think that's a really encouraging way. And again, it does contrast with some other books over the years that have been written where there isn't that kind of slack or latitude or just kind of softer tone.
Absolutely. I mean, this book is really a culmination. I mean, we're avid readers and we just love learning about life. And you know, we read books all the time in different topics, business, ecology, all of that stuff. This book is really a culmination of, we feel like everything we've really learned, you know, through our journey of life up until this point. And one of the things we love about our book is it's appealing to people in many ways. You know, many people are reading this book and they're beginning their vegan journey. Many people are reading this book and they're realizing, man, I've kind of been one of those vegan jerks of the past, and I don't want to be that way anymore. Many people are reading this book and they're becoming very empowered for their own lives. And we're really excited about that. I mean, excuse me, we're getting feedback from, you know, like just the other day, we got feedback from one of our readers who she's like worked up the courage and nerve to enter a lifelong dream of being in her first marathon. And that really is indicative of what we wanted people to get out of this book, which is, it really is, through this book is about our vegan journey, but really it's a book about self-empowerment. It's a book about being the best version of yourself, whatever that means to you.
Yeah. Well, we've gotten some nice emails, including one that unfortunately I can't really address because I think it was a graphic that someone sent in that doesn't translate to my screen here. But another one relative to the protein question says, my answer about protein was always, where does an elephant get their protein? Where does a gorilla get its protein? Plants. That's another good, simple way. Those are some pretty strong, substantial animals, and they seem to be doing okay. So let's talk a little bit more about, not necessarily factory farming, because again, I think those are kind of standard things that people do talk about. But one thing, often it's just, again, it's a personal, specific story that makes a difference. And one of those that I was struck by, among others, in your book was Robert Thornell, or I think is how you pronounce it. Can you talk a little bit about him?
To be honest, I think that sort of, that's flipping my mind right now.
That's the guy who lived adjacent to a factory farm and started to develop some health issues.
Oh my gosh. You know, that's some of the stuff that has floored, you know, when we get into the environmental stuff, and we touch on the environmental stuff in a very big tent way. Like, you know, our book by no means is from some political paradigm. Like, this is a book that really anybody can get down with and really understand what's going on. And when we started digging into a lot of the environmental stuff, it really blew our minds, the crazy stuff that and toxic stuff that's going on factory farms. I mean, some of these farms are so big that they just have like massive lakes of feces, and like there's fumes and these lakes are just kind of like taking over these communities. And a lot of these communities, these people don't have access to decent paying jobs. You know, they're kind of just like they're getting by, and then they have all these health concerns that are popping up due to all the toxins coming from these massive farms, where technically they're regulated and they're monitored. But if you look at the way a lot of these farms are operating, it's still making these people sick. And a lot of these people are, you know, they're getting sick and dying. I mean, there's workers that are dying from the fumes from the toxic lakes. I mean, it's crazy stuff going on.
For sure. Well, that's the thing. And people live nearby, and unfortunately been documented in all kinds of instances where because of those big sort of, lakes of feces and stuff that from the factory farms, and then that can seep into the water supply. And so people in the nearby communities end up ill in one way or another. And that's kind of what the Robert Thornell guy that you guys cite in the book, that's just one example. But so there's just every which way there are implications for factory farming and the people that embrace and support that, and often having no awareness of what the actual consequences and implications are, but they're significant.
Absolutely. And I think that's a major key, is like, I think in the past there's been this view that, like, you know, for vegans in the past, there's sort of this view of like, or this feeling of like an us versus them or them versus them sort of thing. And where we're at is like, we realize like we're all trying to figure life out, you know, it requires you to be extremely delusional to think that, you know, factory farming started because somebody just wanted to be a jerk to animals. Factory farming started because somebody was trying to innovate to find ways to feed more people. And sure, it turns into this crazy, terrible thing, but we all want a better life. So now we realize that we don't have enemies anywhere. Like, people who are working on factory farms, people who own factory farms, people who live adjacent to them, they're all wanting a better life too. And thanks to the freedom of information and, you know, the way like, you know, medicine is improving and technology is improving, we're finding out the causes of a lot of our ailments, sicknesses, and causes of mortality. And now we're able to flip course and start to correct it. You know, it may be slower in some areas, but people are waking up everywhere now. And I think that's a really exciting thing.
For sure. Well, we're in our last moment or two, guys, but again, there's a few emails that I'm probably not going to be able to get to. We had a caller briefly who unfortunately came and went, but one of the emails says, hello, wow, I can totally identify with you regarding social awkwardness and being completely driven with unrelenting energy and passion for conservation. I'm just learning social skills now at 49 and how to handle difficult people after serious struggles. You're an inspiration, and people like you are making a movement to help the culture shift and make a change. It all starts within yourself. It is so important to take care of you first, and the rest will follow. You have to trust the universe. Thank you so much. Can't wait to read your book, ordering it today. So that's really nice. Question that I was going to sort of ask, but this came in just at this moment, basically the same essential question, says, what's next for the vegan bros? Any book tours coming up, etc.? Guys?
Well, sure. I guess I'll go. So, right.
Well, I'm letting you guys sort out the sibling rivalry on some of these things. So.
Yeah, that's funny. Right now we're focused on promoting the book, and we are in the process. We're going to be launching a new company coming up here in the fall, but we're not really discussing that in detail yet. But we're, you know, honestly, this is probably the most excited we've ever been in our entire lives right now.
Okay, cool. So,
big things on the horizon.
That's great. Well, we'll look forward to those announcements. And let me just let folks know, once again, we've been speaking with Matt Letton and Phil Letton, the Vegan Bros. The new book is Vodka is Vegan, A Manifesto for Better Living and Not Being an A-Hole. And again, wherever you get your books, you can get this one. And of course, they have a website, veganbros.com, and also on social media. So every which way you can find out more about these guys and about the book. So Matt and Phil, thank you so much for making the time to join me today on Talking Animals. I appreciate it. It was enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks so much. We had a good time.
Okay, thanks again.
That was fun.
In a few moments, I'll speak with Marilyn Weaver of the League of Humane Voters, Florida, about the effort underway to persuade Governor Scott to reassign the case of the Ocala teacher who drowned those animals in front of his students. It became a huge national story. Anyways, the state attorney initially assigned to this case has opted not to file charges against the teacher. So we'll get into hearing more about that with Marilyn in a moment. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner. Julio Torres is an accomplished writer and rising comic. In the wake of my conversation with the Vegan Bros, I thought we might hear this piece from Julio. This is I Am Vegan from Julio Torres in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Hi. Hi. Hello. Hi. I am Julio. I'm originally from El Salvador. But I live in Brooklyn now. At a, como se dice, vegan queer collective. I am vegan, and I am so sorry. In my experience, the hardest part about being vegan is all of the apologizing. People ask me if I miss meat or dairy. I mean, I miss being liked. I don't miss cheese, but I do miss getting asked to do things. I miss my friends and I miss my family.
That was Julio Torres with a piece called I Am Vegan, taken from an appearance on Conan. Now let's speak with Marilyn Weaver about the effort to urge Governor Scott to reassign the case of the teacher who drowned those animals to a new state attorney, since no charges have been filed thus far This is Marilyn Weaver on Talking Animals. Good morning, Marilyn.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. Let's first, I'd like to ask you to outline just briefly what the Florida chapter of the League of Humane Voters is and what it does.
Yeah, well, we organized because a lot of people were feeling powerless, angry, frustrated, and we decided that we had to do something legislatively. So we are a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to making a difference for animals in the state of Florida. And what we do is we work locally to either endorse or oppose the election of certain candidates for either election or re-election. And we attend commission meetings, we send emails, calls, and we rally our database, which we hope to increase continually, to put pressure on the legislators to listen to us and hear about animal issues. And when we attend commission meetings, they pay attention once we say we're members of the League of Humane Voters. And because we've been doing that, we've been able to change laws, initiate laws, such as anti-chaining of dogs and cats. Now in many counties in Florida, including the Tampa Bay area, you cannot chain a dog outside unless you are outside with that dog within visual range. And then the dog leaves right with you. So we did that. We got TNVR, that's Trap, Neuter, Vaccinate, Return, for the free-roaming cats. Legal in Pinellas County. At one point, it was illegal. So by banding together and joining with the League, we are a powerful lobby for the animals. So I do encourage everybody to join us. There's no charge, and we don't bombard you with emails. So that's the League of Humane Voters, Florida, and our website is www.lohz-fl.org.
Okay, well, that's a great overview. So let's get into a little bit more specifics about this case. Now, this became a national story, but for those listening who are unfamiliar nonetheless, maybe you can describe what happened in this incident.
Yes, it seems that a video went viral, and that's how this all began. Basically, from all the news reports I've been reading, the teacher, Dewey Bruton, suspected that a raccoon had eaten one of the chickens he was raising and was also harming chickens that the class was raising at the school, and he was upset. He said he couldn't shoot the raccoons as it was against the law to bring a gun onto school property. So he decided that the humane way to kill the animals was by drowning, and so he did. He killed two raccoons and an opossum. Of course, he could have called a wildlife rehabber for a non-killing removal of the animals, but evidently, that never came up somehow. But before he initiated the killing, and this is important, he threatened to give a referral to any student in the class who recorded or took pictures of the drowning. The mother of the student who filmed the incident said that her son knew it was wrong to do what they were being forced to do, and that's why he filmed it anyway. So in the video, students can be seen pouring water into the raccoon's cage as it sits in a garbage bin that they filled with water. Multiple students can be seen helping with the drowning while others stand around and watch. And the teacher avoided prosecution after Assistant State Attorney Toby Hunt ruled that he didn't kill the animals to be cruel, but drowned them because he suspected they were killing chickens being raised in his class. And the State Attorney Hunt also noted that a jury recently acquitted a man charged with animal cruelty after he cut off the tails of four kittens, with rusty scissors. He said in a memo that this teacher did not torment the animals and was not unnecessarily cruel as he held them in the trash can filled with water, which is quite a revelation on what cruelty is. Also, there was an illegal steel trap called a carnivore that was found by the authorities under a chicken pen. So right away, that's an illegal thing that he did as well.
Yeah. Well, also, in seeing a copy of the incident report, it seemed like the state attorney's office not only said the things that you said about another case and therefore, I guess, was part of the reasoning behind not filing charges here, but also, as you kind of alluded to before, I guess it was considered tricky, at least from some of the parents of the kids' standpoint, to be involved. They didn't necessarily want to be involved in testifying. And the video that did go viral, I guess, had its own tricky element to it, since I guess it was hard to authenticate, according to the state attorney. And for what it's worth, the teacher had asked that people not shoot video. So I guess the question is, Marilyn, from the standpoint of the League of Humane Voters of Florida or otherwise, is there a chance that this could be reassigned to a different state attorney for a different outcome?
Well, that's what we're shooting for. The Animal Legal Defense Fund and the Humane Society of the United States, as well as us, are asking for very polite calls to be made to Florida Governor Scott's office requesting the reassignment of this case to another state attorney. We have a number that people can reach Governor Scott at, and it's 850-717-9337 or 850-488-7146. And again, I want to stress, please be very polite, even though this issue has raised such intense, abhorrent feelings about what happened, please do not get angry with the person who answers the phone, but ask them very politely to reassign this case, because the animals, if we can persuade the governor to assign the case, these tortured animals might get a second chance at justice.
Yeah.
And we will be making clear that animal cruelty should be punished in Florida.
For sure. Well, we don't have much time left. We just have a few seconds left, Marilyn. But I'm just going to quickly ask, and just for a quick answer, for your opinion. I mean, my concern, and I think others, has been Governor Scott is, the phrase I've been using, is the lamest of lame ducks at the moment, including obviously avidly running for the Senate. So what do people think, your kind of expertise, the prospects are of him taking this seriously and reassigning the case?
Well, I don't know how seriously he'll take it, but I always tell people, call your local electors, call your commissioners, let them know how you feel, and let them also put some pressure on the governor.
Yeah.
Because we're in an election year.
And okay.
That's when they listen, and if you join the league and tell them you're a member and that you vote, I can guarantee you they will start listening, because that's what they care about, your vote.
Right. Okay, Marilyn, well, we're out of time now, but thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, and let's hope people do call, and also on a couple different Facebook pages of mine, the Talking Animals radio show page, my personal page. I also put there's a petition by the Animal Legal Defense Fund on the same matter, but let me give those phone numbers one more time to call Governor Scott's office to urge him to reassign the case and see if we can get some justice here. It's 850-717-9337 or 850-488-7146. Marilyn, thank you so much for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Yes, and thank you for being a voice for the animals, Duncan.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Bye.
All right, coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lurie and Radioactivity, kicking off a 3-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including the noon hour midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott in the All Souls edition of It's the Music. It's Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. NPR News headlines coming up. Thanks so much for listening.